This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the head priest and training coordinator at Zen Mountain Monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. I know I saw a lot of first-time people go upstairs this morning, so welcome to all of you. Glad to have you here at the temple. And what I chose this morning was, you know how sometimes you're reading the Dharma and there's just some passages that really get to you in different ways, and this is one of those that I've always loved. And it's by Dogen, who is a brilliant 13th century Japanese master. And he wrote a fascicle out of a large volume of profound spiritual writing on the nature of who we are and what things are. And this is entitled From the King of Samadhi, or sometimes the King of Concentration, the King of Wise Meditation, has a couple names. Shakyamuni Buddha said to the assembly, "When you sit in the meditation posture, you realize samadhi in body and mind, and give rise to an awesome virtue that people respect. Like the sun illuminating and refreshing the world, this sitting removes obscurities from the mind and lightens the body so that exhaustion is set aside. Enlightenment becomes as natural as a dragon curled up at rest. A demon is frightened even by a picture of someone sitting in meditation posture. How much more so by a living person who realizes the way, sitting motionless and at ease." So I wanted to look at the importance of why we develop concentration and how this falling away falls into the fold of bodhisattvic citizenship, being a bodhisattva citizen. A bodhisattva citizen, for those of you who are new, a bodhisattva is one who, with their actions and practices, want to benefit not only themselves, but all life. And so the concentration to enter our own cave and then come out into the world. And every time I hear this passage about a demon is frightened even by a picture of someone sitting in the meditation posture, I've told this many times that I remember we used to sit with the doors open and someone was on the sidewalk on their cell phone and everyone was sitting and everyone's just sitting and he's just all out right in front of the doorway. And then he turns around and sees the silhouettes of all these people sitting, and I heard him go like, "What? I don't know what I'm. Wait a minute. What am I looking at? I think they're people. Oh my God, they're all just sitting still, like stumps." And I could feel that his demons got sort of scared. Like he felt some connection at that moment to what was happening in here, though he couldn't quite place it. So, in Fukan Zazengi, Dogen said, speaking of Zazen, "Once its heart is grasped, Zazen, you are like a dragon when she gains the water, like the tiger when they enter the mountain." So when a dragon enters the water or a tiger enters the mountain, it's speaking of like we're in our element. Like when we can really like sit into ourselves, we really sit into who we are, We sit into our element, our true element, our original nature, when we're totally engaged in Zazen. And so every day, I think I'm not alone in this. We don't always know, in one sense, the water we're in. Some of us take for granted the water we can swim in so freely. There's lots of kinds of waters and lots of beings that see water differently. And sometimes my heart, every day, I know I wake up at night sometimes with a heaviness about the world, the suffering, and I feel this urgent call to for my bodhisattva citizen to emerge. And I'm thankful for the news. And I've talked about what kind of news we tune into that comes from every direction. It's one of the ways we can communicate. And of course, what we often considered was private. We know nothing is hidden. Even if it seems private, it's not hidden. There's mirrors all around. So how do I respond? How do we respond as meditators, as practitioners? How do we make a positive move in this world? How do we serve as bodhisattvas? How do we calm our hearts and minds and our own conditioning so that we can act in wise and compassionate and a merciful way? How can we assume a bodhisattvic posture, one that actually makes a difference, so that we're not causing more suffering and delusion by our inaction or ignorance? So enlightenment becomes as natural as a dragon curled up at rest. A demon is frightened even by a picture of someone sitting in meditation. When you sit in the meditation posture, you realize samadhi and body and mind and give rise to an awesome virtue that people respect. I wonder about that translation of awesome. Like, did Dogen really say awesome? It is an awesome virtue. So dragons play many roles in Zen literature. Sometimes they're wonderful water-dwelling creatures who bring good fortune. But they're called the Nagas. And our wilderness trip with women, we were all Nagas. And I donned myself Lady Naga. They can be symbols for enlightenment because they're holding this jewel, like they're curled up, and inside is this jewel that we have that we don't often see. And to get to it, you got to go through what's called the cave of the blue dragon. Meeting the dragon in the blue cave, which means we have to go through and confront our deepest fears and obstacles. You know, Daido Roshi used to speak of the cave of the blue dragon. He has a koan on it where we store our psychological bilge, he would call it. Once, maybe part of his sailor life coming through, the psychological bilge. And if you've ever been on a boat where the bilge is clogged, you know what happens in the boat, right? It all starts coming up. And you're like walking in it, and it starts rising, you know. And that's kind of what happens to us if we don't take care of it, right? He used to say, your bilge is up to here, and somebody says, how you doing? And you go, fine, before you go under. So it's difficult to go here. It takes a certain degree of fearlessness to face ourselves, and the process of Zazen engages this. It engages the fear in order to empower fearlessness. So right there, when we meet a fear, fearlessness starts to get empowered as soon as we meet it. It's mutually arising, right? So when strong feelings come up, we don't use zazen as a way to suppress. When something comes up in meditation, it's a signal we need to deal with something and process it thoroughly and fearlessly, feel it and experience it, and then let go and come back to the moment. A bodhisattva is an awakened being who is willing to engage the world to protect and awaken others. Let's see what I can find, what I'm looking for. A citizen takes responsibility for the well-being of where they live and finds ways to support communities that are likely to be endangered. So I'm putting the two together. Pema Chodron wrote, "When you hear some teaching that rings true to you and you feel some trust in practicing the way and some trust in it being a worthwhile way to live, then you're in for a lot of inconvenience." And when I read that, I was just like, that's so, like, how do you even take that in? Like, I thought she was saying, then you're in for this amazing, no, you're in for a lot of inconvenience. And it's part of that, like, maybe if I didn't know, it would be more convenient. Like, if I could just be ignorant and I didn't practice anything, maybe that would be better. But when you find something that you actually, a path, and you start going in and you feel some trust and it's worthwhile, then you're in for a lot of inconvenience because everything's going to come up. And from an everyday perspective, she says, it seems good to do things that are kind of convenient. There's no problem with this. But when we begin to take the path of the Buddha Dharma, how true this really is. So when we want to start to live our life fully, when we turn towards practice, towards zazen in particular, and feel a passion for life and growth and dying to our solid sense of ourself and seeing everyone else in that same way, then basically when we follow our heart, we're going to meet inconvenience. So what wisdom can be drawn from such a statement, given our propensity for entitlement, comfort, shortcuts, reactivity? What about the path of least resistance? How do we find ourselves choosing this anyway? We did. And we may have thought that in the beginning of practice we would immediately enter a profound ocean of bliss. I mean, I'm coming here to hit the bliss. And we might, actually. We might begin to touch our naturalness and feel that restful dragon in the water, that tiger in the mountain. And then over time, we see it's not so peaceful. It's not an ocean of bliss. And we find ourselves suddenly in a storm in the middle of the ocean. And that storm, of course, is our mind. And we then see it's not so easy to take a straight look at ourselves and what we do. So it could be in the beginning initially uncomfortable, unsettling, embarrassing. You know, sometimes I'm embarrassed at what's going on in my own thoughts. Nobody else knows, but I'm like embarrassed. And even as we sit here, we might notice we're in a very inconvenient state. How many of us have thought about leaving in a period of zazen, leaving the zendo? I don't want to do this anymore. So then we're not quite here and not quite there. Right? We're in a bardo, we call it. And though we think it may be more convenient to be at home or someplace else, we're like in between. No, this is good for me. No, I should probably go, right? And I was thinking, it reminded me of when I was a little girl in Atlantic City. That's where I spent my summers. And I was a bit of a fish as a little kid. I had asthma. And my doctor had this great recommendation. Put her in water. Like, let her swim. Like, get her lungs going. So I was in water. Most of us were, because we grew up around it. Pretty young. And, you know, I started to develop quite a comfort being in there and with the breaking waves, and I didn't wear sneakers or anything. Like, the bottom of the floor didn't bother me with all the stuff I couldn't see or in the darkness. Sometimes the water was pretty treacherous and full of currents and overlapping waves. And if you were in the water a lot, you started to, you know, you always had to keep a awareness, but you started to understand some of the rhythms that happened and where the dangers might be, but never knowing for sure, and seeing how it's possible to swim through some currents, around, into, and bob under and dive under fierce waves and not get pounded by them. And I think the key to that experience was I felt part of the ocean. Like, I felt like I was the ocean. And I started to play in it. And being a child, no matter what, there was kind of this fish-like joy of ease and ease swimming around. And I think we want to find that same thing, at least I did, in Zazen. Just this way to just sit there and go under the fierce waves and ride currents and stay as part of this giant ocean and not get caught in these waves and these currents and these undertows and overtows. To find this natural joy in our lives and hopes of experiencing each moment that present for what it is, fresh moment-to-moment awareness. And in the initial stage of our practice, many of us manage to find a quiet space that opens us up to our spaciousness and our spontaneous nature. We start to touch that. And buoyed by this, our practice is gratifying, and it keeps us going for a while. And then, of course, the inevitable happens where things start arising. Distractions, doubts, difficulties. There's times I've been in the ocean where the floor has come right out. Like, something grabbed my feet and I was twirling in whole mixture with my eyes open, almost feeling like I was might drown until popped up, or somebody reached down once and pulled up this little kid, you know. I was still spinning around. So luckily I was pulled up. Whether it's a subtle change in our schedule, a loss of faith, we lose our footing. And sometimes we forget we even have a practice, or that we sat down with ourselves and had this access point. We forget. It's not what we turn to. How do we remember that we have a practice in those times where we're twirling? Sometimes we forget for weeks at a time. I can't because I'm on schedule. But, you know, some of you have to put it together all the time at home and sit down by yourself. That we can release the spinning mind, concentrate, and get to the source. So the practice of Zazen is the practice of coming back to the actual right now in this moment self, coming back to the self, coming back to the naturalness, the intimacy and simplicity of our true nature. We're complicated, but that we're always sitting with that depth. That is always here. We're always sitting with that depth of our consciousness, no matter what's going on. We're just, as I spoke before, We're tuned into a different channel, perhaps. We speak of the heart of Zen as Zazen. And that practice is not something we do, it's what we are. That's what we are. We are practice. I mean, that takes a while to sink in. That it's not the practice, it's the life. It's the this. The this. Zazen does not involve complicated instructions, right? Those of you that received it, it wasn't that complicated. How to arrange your body so that you can sit comfortably in stillness, and then you were introduced to a mind practice, a way to begin concentrating, counting the breath. And, you know, if we look at the ancient meditation instructions, they're all quite simple and actually surprisingly brief, how to practice Zazen. So while Dogen speaks of the possibility of attaining the freedom and naturalness of a tiger in the mountains or a dragon in the water, the actual instructions are so concrete, right? This is how you do it. It's very particular and concrete, this naturalness and this joy. Meanwhile, we got showed how to sit, very particular and concrete. I always found that so interesting. How particular, your hands are like this, your mudra touches lightly, shoulders are back, like all these very particular ways to open this temple. Sit in the proper posture and attend to the body, breath, and mind. All the disparate ideas, thoughts, and impulses, everything comes and goes, and yet you sit. And little by little, the chatter drops away, and your body and your mind and your breath are one. Zazen is really simple. And that state is always present. Focus on your posture, on counting your breath, and in a natural way, this unified mind that we call samadhi will develop. Can't be forced. It's just doing that practice and trusting it. Okay, that's what's been given for thousands of years. That's been working. So it's not about reaching 10, right? And you'll see if you'll get feedback if you're the person who's galloping like to 10. You probably do that in a lot of places in life, the goal. I'm supposed to get to 10. No, 1, 2, and everything in between, being there. And we just keep letting the mind settle. So it's the training we need. The training is what we're doing, because it has always been running like havoc. We call it like a monkey in a jungle. Right, swinging from thought to thought, grab a vine, swing, grab a vine, swing, grab a vine, swing. And we're like, shoo. And in our head, it might still be swinging, but we're sitting still, right? I'm working with that. Don't worry about whether practice is working. Don't judge your performance. Don't tell yourself stories. Find other ways to avoid this present moment. And that's what we see, just all the ways. Why is it so hard to be here? Really? They're all just ways of separating from our deepest intention and our Zazen. When we do Zazen, just do Zazen, that's enough. All of us yearn to experience ourselves whole and complete, to live our lives fully and freshly in each moment. But something blocks us. And this is one way, if we follow through with it, to see that all along we have what we need. All along, we have what we need. And that's called the realization of the original self. When that rests and you really begin to experience that, you start to put light on it. Zazen is a form that allows us to practice no form of boundless emptiness. The outer form helps us by organizing and directing our energies. But we carry our form lightly, with respect and appreciation for its gifts. So this subtle discipline, settling, unifying, letting be, is called the Dharma Gate of peace and joy. Just that. That's what we enter. There is one more thing to keep in mind. While these instructions can help us establish our own daily meditation, Zen is not a solitary practice. It can be, but it's a way of using our mind, living our life, and doing it with others. We go into the world. None of us, I don't think, if you're here today, you are not a hermit. You have come out of your cave. So being with people is an integral part, especially in this city. You know, when I'm in the mountains, I can find loads of time to not see anyone. You know, my A-frame is back in the woods. I can just dissolve there. I don't. So Zazen, and we repeat this a lot, is not just facing ourselves against the wall, as we call it, wall gazing, or just staring at our navel, sitting quietly. It's much larger. And so some of the oldest Buddhist teachings we have are called the Eightfold Path, which is what Buddha laid out as the path of freedom, the 8 points in the life of Dharma that are said to lead us to a way of finding the Buddha way that the Four Noble Truths indicate. So for those of you that are new, what are the Four Noble Truths? And they're called noble because they liberate us from suffering. They're Buddha's basic teaching encapsulating the Buddha's path. So first he speaks of life is suffering. Life always involves suffering in obvious and subtle forms. Even when things seem good, we always feel an undercurrent of anxiety and uncertainty inside. The cause of suffering, the second noble truth, knowing this, which can liberate us, is the cause of suffering is craving and our fundamental not knowing or ignorance about who we are. We suffer because of our mistaken belief that we are separate, independent, a solid I. The painful and futile struggle to remain in this delusion of ego is known as samsara, or cyclic existence. The third noble truth is we can put an end to suffering. Our obscurations are temporary, right? The sun illuminating and refreshing the world, the sitting removes obscurities from the mind and lightens the body so that exhaustion is set aside. That our obscurations are temporary. They are like passing clouds that obscure the sun of our enlightened nature, which is always there. That's that what is always present. Therefore, suffering can end because our obscurations can be purified, seen for what they are, and the awakened mind is always available to us. That's what we awaken to. That's what we're sitting with. That's what we need the concentration to see. And then the path. By living ethically, practicing meditation, and developing wisdom, we can take exactly the same journey to waking up and freedom from suffering that Buddhas do. We too can wake up. So Buddha offered these eight places. Right view, having a right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and the right concentration. So I've been touching on right concentration. And I don't know, he has right view first, but I, and they all occur actually simultaneously, but I feel like maybe right concentration is first, to have a right view and a right intention, the right samadhi, because it serves as our foundation to have the right view and right intention. You can study it yourself. And this word right, okay, so some of us who are kind of rebels, we don't like this word. So it's not as opposed to wrong, okay? It's not right as opposed to wrong. It comes from sama in Pali, which is translated as wise, skillful, or wholesome. So wholesome view, a skillful view, a wise view, a wise action, a wise livelihood, a wholesome livelihood, skillful concentration. And concentration comes from the Sanskrit word samadhi, which means the same. The same. I like that because it's like distilling the essence. Concentrating. It's like distilling the essence. The same. Getting to the level ground. When we sit in meditation, we focus our energies. And I know, sometimes I sit down and at first it's just la, 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 like la, la land. Like I was thrilled when that film came out. I thought it was about Zazen maybe. And that first stage of like when we're in like la, 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 like whoa. And we have to kind of focus. And how does that focus come? Breath. It comes from a single breath can focus us immediately. Out on the street, on our seat, a breath can bring us right back into focus. Concentration. You can feel it in your hara. You can feel it in your belly. Focus. It's a real thing. And that's why sometimes when people say they can't sit, I say, can you just do three inhales and exhales on the edge of your bed before you leave? Just three. Just show up completely for three of them. And that concentration is a world, is a world in itself. And you know, one of the basic introductory instructions is to rest your tongue on the upper palate behind your front teeth. That is amazing. That little part of our body that does that, in times of stress, watch, your tongue goes up to that. It's fascinating. Like you're like, that's because it's so natural to like help us focus and release. It stops reactivity. It helps us be present. Just that light touch behind our front teeth. Even in yoga, they use it too. It adds an energy to the body of focusing. It's the habit of concentration we want to develop. So not all habits are bad. This is a good habit. However, how we use it, it's not to disappear and want to just go into the empty world. Not that a working samadhi is necessary as well. The wholesome samadhi that holds you. It's a together-making thing. It pulls us back to ourself and to our complete true self. Shakyamuni Buddha said to the assembly, when you sit in the meditation posture, you realize samadhi in body and mind and give rise to an awesome virtue that people respect. like the sun illuminating and refreshing the world. This sitting removes obscurities from the mind, enlightens the body so that exhaustion is set aside. Enlightenment becomes as a dragon, as natural as a dragon curled up to rest. Can't you see that? That little dragon curled up to rest. There was this a tale of seeing the true dragon. It's often told in Chinese folktale. And it's used as a parable because it's like we want to see the true dragon, but then when we see it, oh my God. So this is Kung Tzu was a man who loved dragons. He studied dragon lore and decorated his home with paintings and statues of dragons. He would talk on and on about dragons to anyone who would listen. One day, a dragon heard about Kung Tzu and thought, how lovely. This man so appreciates us. I'm going to make him happy and pay him a visit. Let him meet a true dragon. So the kindly dragon flew over to Kung Tzu's house and went inside to find Kung Tzu asleep. Then Kung Tzu woke up and saw the dragon coiled by his bed, its scales and teeth glittering in the moonlight. And he screamed in terror. Before the dragon could introduce himself, like, hey, I'm your true dragon here, he grabbed his sword and he lunged at the dragon, and the dragon flew away. It's kind of what we do, you know? It's like when we find ourselves falling away, like all those obscurations and habits come back, so like, no, I don't want to see this. Like that. Like, what is this? What is this that has just come in? So sometimes they say it's someone who has an intellectual interest in Buddhism and reads a lot of books, but doesn't feel a need to practice, find a teacher, or take refuges. such a person prefers a false Buddhism to the real thing, or it might refer to being afraid to let go of self-clinging in order to realize enlightenment. We see this dragon and then we want to kill it. Interesting. So this dragon, the demon, is frightened by the picture of someone who realizes sitting in the meditation posture. I love this imagery, this awesome virtue, the sun illuminating. You know, suddenly it's clear, even what we obscure, even a demon, our little demons pull away when they see us sitting in this wonderful illuminating quality of concentration and focus, right? So, you know, I say, like, some people I say what I learned from Sokmi Rinpoche, he calls them beautiful monsters. And they pop up when we're sitting, and we take them, like the imagery. And he says, you got to, you know, make peace with those little monsters. They need some nectar from us. So what do you feed them? How do they relax? It reminds us that realizing samadhi is right here. It's not like, oh, I will attain samadhi. No, it's not a theoretical or abstract thing. It's right here in our breath, in 1 to 10, in our body now. And as I said, Daido would say, don't make it into being a zombie, into no-thingness. The awesome virtue, perhaps you don't even see it or notice it, that it arises when we sit. And we may not realize that that's what we actually offer to others as we walk out the door, right? This awesome virtue. The samadhi is really powerful. And if we're not careful, we might discover we'll find our true nature, who we really are, and then what? The inconvenience of how we need to function in the world. And I've seen it happen over and over again, this realization of this not being so centralized on our selfish self, but our individual self, but realizing who we are is so much bigger and we can take care of so much more. And this wisdom, when we settle in the way that dragon does to our samadhi, our demons, our certainty, our viciousness, our anger, our pettiness, they become frightened by this power of this dragon that sits. This is part of everything in the world. They are frightened by the awesome presence of a bodhisattva. We're arming ourselves with stability, concentration, and wisdom so that we can act, not react, but be responsible. So I encourage you to pay attention and sit zazen. Enjoy your samadhi like the dragon does. That bodhisattva that you are, that can work with the horrors of the world right now. It's not hiding from the injustice of the world as we sit here this Sunday morning. We're arming ourselves with stability, concentration, and wisdom. Don't block the way. We're not living in clouds. We chant, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. So who are these sentient beings that we vow to save? Are they the sentient beings, those that I agree with, that I save? How can we find in our hearts to serve them all? How do we attend to the whole picture to serve everyone? Each of us can make a difference, not judging anyone that we meet, but feeling compassion, finding a way to make a difference. The true dragon, which Dogen wrote in Fukan Zazengi, he wrote, I beseech you, noble friends, in learning through experience, do not become so accustomed to images that you are dismayed by the true dragon. Thank you. Have a wonderful day. And soar into the world and give your steadiness, your fearlessness when you feel fearful. See how we can meet each other and understand that we might see one aspect of water quite differently, that we all don't swim so easily. And it's how do we make this the true home for all beings.
Thanks so much for listening. The monastery's quarterly journal, Mountain Record, has a new home at mountainrecord.org. For over 30 years, Mountain Record has been offering spiritual seekers of all faiths a unique journey through words and images. Each quarterly issue delivers a thought-provoking array of classic teachings, contemporary wisdom, stunning photographs, and news from the Mountains and Rivers Order. For more information, to subscribe, or to read our open access articles, visit mountainrecord.org.